2005 Sunstone Symposium presents session number 134, a panel discussion, Brigham and Buddha, Eastern Practice and Philosophies That Enhance Our Mormon Spiritual Lives, with Phil McLemore, Edwin B. Firmage, John T. Kessler, and Edwin Firmage, Jr.
Our first speaker will be Phil McLemore. I met Phil at Benchmark Books many years ago as he's been an Air Force chaplain and traveling around, and eventually since he was his library just got hard to haul around over there, so we kind of became friends. And then, it's just been a wonderful, mutually enriching dialogue that we've had all these years. Phil has now retired from the military, and now he's a hospice chaplain here in Northern Utah. And among the things that Phil does, I'm sure he'll tell his own story, is he began meditating for some pain management reasons, and then now as a certified instructor in certain meditation techniques and has done those successfully. So we're excited to have him. Ed Firmage, Sr., many of you will know as someone who's been a long-time Latter-day Saint and reflector on deep psychology, Jungian concepts, and things like that. And he's brought lots of disciplines and interests together in a very neat and wonderful way. And we're grateful to have him here at Sunstone after many years of being away from us. He's also going to be an interview subject. Is it Friday or Saturday? I should have double-checked.
Saturday.
So if you'll get to know a lot more about Ed on Saturday. So we'll hopefully get a nice little taste here. But among the many things that he's done in his social activism and things is he was one of the people who helped arrange for Dalai Lama to visit Utah back in 2001, and we're excited for that to hear from him. John Kessler is an attorney. He's a consultant and a lecturer. He practices commercial law and meditation. Mediation, excuse me. That's right, law and mediation. He also practices meditation, so I just skipped ahead there. He works in the area of individual organizational community integration and transformation. He has consulting affiliations with the Bacana Institute and the Integral Institute. And he'll talk more about his affiliation with the Integral Institute in a panel session tomorrow about Ken Wilber. And I am on that with him. And we're both fans of his work. He's recently been the chair of several nonprofits, including the University of Utah Hospitals and Clinics, the Bacana Institute, and the Integrative Health Network. And John is a certified instructor in Genpo Roshi, who runs the Zen Center, Kenzen Zen Center here. And Genpo Roshi has developed a technique called the Big Mind Process, and it was a real... John will tell you his experiences with that. Ed Firmage, it's not really junior, so we decided for simplicity and all that to kind of go with that in the program, has a master's degree in ancient history and Mediterranean archaeology from UC Berkeley, Hebrew University, and the American University of Cairo. Is that how it works? So which are which? Sure.
The degree is from Berkeley, but the others were points along the way.
Okay, the degree is from Berkeley. His career is as a fine art photographer, and he has a recent book, Red Rock, Yellow Stone, which is a compilation of photographs and Japanese haiku. And he mentioned to me on the phone that this has just sort of become a real spiritual kind of a marriage for him and his own mind. So we're excited to hear from all these great speakers.
Well, Dan asked me to come and simply tell my story. I think below his breath he was saying, then we'll leave the intelligent stuff to these scholarly types over here. So we'll start light and get heavy. I grew up Catholic, went to an all-boy high school. I'm essentially a product of Jesuit priests. My mother got mad at one of the priests. And when I graduated from school, Latin was boring. And anyway, when she stopped going to church, I stopped going to church. And had a period between 17 and 19 where I really wasn't affiliated with any religious organization. I was always intrigued by what people believed and what impact the beliefs had in their daily living. Now, this is during the 60s, and Eastern stuff was becoming very popular, and I'm kind of searching, looking for something. And there was a girl named Lark who lived behind us, and she was that classic hippie type, beads, and I went to visit her one day, and she was sitting in a lotus position meditating, and incense was burning, and so she invited me in for a little meditation. I thought, oh, this is fun. So I tried to get into the lotus position. The incense started giving me a headache. My knees were just killing me. And I said, Lark, I got to go, man, and I just left. And I came to that conclusion that I was definitely not destined to be a Buddhist. It was just too painful. And I pretty much limited my exploration there to attending the churches of girls I was dating and experienced a number of Protestant churches. If there was a tent meeting on the side of the road, I was there. Kind of exploring and so forth. At 19, it's a longer story, but at 19, I became converted and joined the Mormon Church. Three reasons. The doctrine made a whole lot more sense than the stuff I was getting in Catholic Protestant circles. It seemed to me that the religion, the beliefs of the people was more integrally involved in their lives day to day. And I'd had a profound spiritual experience that was very stabilizing to me, and thus I began my life as a Mormon at 19. I went on a mission a year later, and after I came back and graduated from college, a wonderful Latter-day Saint named Jim Christensen, who's no longer with us, backdoored me into the CES, and I served as Institute Director at Auburn and later University of Georgia. I read every LDS book ever in print, out of print. If people were thinking about printing, I was reading their minds to get, you know, the first review. Any magazine available, from the encouraging enzyme to the dangerous dialogue, to the sarcastic but seductive Sunstone. I think I'm channeling Elder Maxwell there. Anyway, I'm reading tons of stuff, but it was always in the Western, you know, kind of concrete, hardcore religion philosophy. Eastern stuff was so airy-fairy for me, and I just couldn't connect to it at all. My biggest disappointment in my early days in the church, frankly, was the lack of what I perceived as transformation in people that I thought should have been better. You know, there was such a great transformation in me in 1 year. I figured, gosh, if you've been a Latter-day Saint for 50 years, you know, I thought eternal progression meant progression. And so I was stunned to see people who've been members of the church for, you know, 15, 20, 30, 40 years, but functioning what I consider to be a rather primitive level spiritually. I had the opportunity to go into the chaplain service as a chaplain, and did that for 20 years and got to really work intimately with Protestant ministers, Catholic priests, rabbis, imams, really at ground level. Met some wonderful folks, but again, I was disappointed. These are the spiritual leaders, and I just didn't feel that what I expected in Christ-like living was present. Now, you meet those great individuals who just have that spark and that growth and that Christ-like nature, but in my experience, it was always related to the individual himself and not the system of religion that they were representing. Well, 30 years roll by, and frankly, I felt so validated by my success in my job, my success in church callings and activities, and just the fact that I was having spiritual experiences regularly, that frankly, I didn't honestly face the lack of deep spiritual transformation in my own life. At work, I was quite an angel. At home, I could be defensive, selfish, judgmental, impatient, and frankly, I lacked the emotional vulnerability to really love deeply. I often approach these failures in typical Mormon fashion. Goal setting, scripture study, prayer. And I was hardcore. And I'm not kidding, 30 years of wanting to be better. I made pitiful progress, mainly in the area of loving my wife the way she deserved, and frankly, it took way too long. In August of 2000, I kind of reached the pinnacle of what I felt was success. I had a great job of some responsibility. I had theological certainty. I had the universe figured out. I could teach the gospel with pretty good impact. I'd overcome some serious character flaws, and I'd learned how to really love my wife. And I felt very successful at that. Now, last night I asked her how good I was, and she says, "You're better." In any case, I was in Honolulu, Hawaii, in the stake center. I just gave a talk on the atonement. I was so pleased with it. And I was standing in the parking lot, and I thought, I've made it. And I'm ready to die. And I felt like I just had no fear whatsoever. Well, oh, what a difference a month can bring. A year earlier, in July of 99, I had injured this quarter of my body. Injuries to my thoracic and cervical spine, tore my shoulder up in a number of different ways. But the symptoms were like time bombs. They really didn't. September of 2000, and just literally, almost out of the blue, dizziness, severe muscle spasms, headaches, really bizarre pain patterns, panic attacks, anxiety, depression. It was an ocean of misery, that's all I can say. The problem is, anytime a doctor thinks you're a mental case, a stress case, then they stop looking for stuff. And the underlying injuries that were manifesting all these symptoms literally went undiagnosed for about 18 months, which meant I was misdiagnosed, misunderstood, mistreated, and in a whole lot of confusion and instability, fear, and pain. Again, I approached this in typical Mormon fashion, right? Huh? Goal setting, scripture study, prayer, and I had to get some blessings in there. Now, I went for the person that I felt was purest in heart and had the purest faith, and that was my son. He'd just come home from a mission. He was created in the image of his mother, and I asked for a blessing, which he gave me. The blessing was very comforting. Didn't change a whole lot. My bishop, out of compassion and love, blessed me. I appreciated it. Didn't change a whole lot. My state president, I think out of duty, blessed me. And I got markedly worse for about 2 weeks. It was all, I'm just miserable. I'm laughing now, but I was a mess. I studied faith, I sought for faith, and frankly, at my deepest opening for salvation, the hand of God put two things in my presence. The first was a book called Full Catastrophe Living by Jon Kabat-Zinn. He was the, in those days, he was the director of the Stress Reduction Clinic of the University of Massachusetts Medical School. He essentially took the Buddhist principles and applied it to stress reduction in a very nice way. And so through that book, I started learning a mindfulness meditation, doing yoga, and it was very effective. I mean, it was amazingly effective. I started 10 minutes, and it was hard. The whole meditation thing was very difficult for me, but it was a time period where I had no symptoms. It was a time period where I would feel normal. And it began to dawn on me, man, if I can be symptom-free for 10 minutes, why can't I be symptom-free for 10 hours or 20 hours? I mean, it gave me just a lot of hope. The next thing that came to me was an audio program by Deepak Chopra, and it was transforming. I felt so empowered and hopeful that healing was possible that I digested every one of his books and audio programs out there. And then I sought instruction in his particular form of mantra meditation, to which I'm a current devotee. And as you know, a mantra is a device designed to take one through the through and beyond the slavery of conditioned thoughts and emotions to the experience of true spirit. I mean, that's how I define a mantra. And so I began this mantra meditation more in a Hindu kind of tradition than a Buddhist. Now, in addition to the symptom-free space that I began to have, some other things began to happen to me. First of all, my face and head started going into wild spasms. I mean, I'm sitting down to meditate, and my face is just twitching and flying off. I thought I was having a stroke. And I thought, well, man, this is it. The Lord's just going to take me, and then I'll be symptom-free. But somehow intuitively, I realized this is my body's way of de-stressing. And this went on for weeks. I mean, it was just letting go of stress. The other thing I began to notice was that my scripture study and prayer time was so much more profound and meaningful. I was seeing stuff in the scriptures I just had never seen before. I suddenly realized that meditation wasn't about relaxation, but it was about an awakening into the spirit and a communion with the spirit that had the power to heal and transform. The breakthrough for me came when, and meditators have had this experience, you finally, your concentration gets to the point where you're actually able to enter a state where you've detached from your body, you've detached from your thoughts. Thoughts aren't happening, you're not in your body necessarily, and you're still there. And not only are you still there, you are really there. It's an experience of yourself as spirit. It is transforming. And I was so touched by the sacredness of that realization, I felt like I had to meditate differently. So I went and bought a little Zen meditation bench, the little bitty ones, where you're able to meditate. I still couldn't get in that lotus thing, man. That is so painful. I can meditate. Good thing for me. The bliss and peace, the spiritual connection I was experiencing, was so wonderful that the misery, the symptoms and the pain that I had, I felt was a small price to pay for what I was going through. And I was willing to endure it just as the ticket price for that. And then I had some, what I call cosmic stuff happening. I began to experience the presence of spiritual beings. I began to experience I began to have an awareness of energy flowing around me and in me, the awareness of life force in nature. Don't wrap me up, but a tree in my backyard became a good friend. And there was a star that I connected with this star. Now, what am I describing? I'm describing a sense of unity with not only the Creator, but the creation. So this star I would see peering down here. I get at 5:30 to meditate, and I go out, and it was the same star in the same place. And for me, it was the eye of God just looking down, watching over me. And it was wonderful. I had a timeless experience where I experienced the past as a present moment reality. It's indescribable. In April of 2000, I took my mother to a physical therapy appointment early. Didn't have my normal time to meditate, so I'm meditating in the parking lot with all this traffic going by. I'm thinking, man, this isn't going to work. And so I'm sitting in the front seat, and all of a sudden I had this altered state where I felt like my soul stepped through my eyes out into unbounded space. I mean, I don't know how to describe it, but it was cosmic. And my mind engages, and it says, you've made it, right? It's happening, brother. And the thought was, I'm going to be having this every day. But what happened the next day? Nothing. Really. It was so disappointing. Fortunately, I discussed this with Chopra, and he taught me the very important principle that to not get attached to the highs of meditation. Don't make meditation an end in itself. And he says that's where a lot of people stop. They start having these wonderful, spiritual, relaxing, cosmic experiences. Boop, they stop. He says the proof of the value of your meditation is the quality of your spiritual growth in your day-to-day life. And so if I have a cosmic experience, yabba-dabba-do, I appreciate it. Keep the practice. All right. Well, my routine has now expanded page three and final page. My routine is now expanded to breath work. I do some chanting. I picked a chant that's supposed to stimulate your pituitary gland. Why not? But it's a vibration that unifies my body. I mean, I just feel unified through the chanting. So I do my breathing, my chanting. I do my mantra meditation. I do a little sutra meditation you know about. I try to do and pray. At the 3.5 year point after starting this, you just become aware of something that's grown to when you're so tall. I suddenly became aware that my problems with defensiveness, selfishness, impatience, judgmentalism, emotional honesty were gone. I hadn't worked on them. The positive spiritual qualities I had worked for so hard and failed at for over 30 years had simply unfolded as I had opened my life to the Spirit. And actually, my session tomorrow is about how mechanically how that happens. And sometimes when we get together, my children are still trying to figure out what has happened to me. Sometimes we get together and they'll go, who is that guy? Well, however you do it, the gospel, the spiritual quest, has got to be more than the practice of a religion and the having of periodic spiritual experiences. It just has to be more than that. It has to be about rebirth. It has to be about transformation. So I'll conclude in the words of the Jesuit, right? I never know how to pronounce this guy's name. Help me. Pierre? Thank you. In his words, this is all. I no longer feel like a human being trying to have a spiritual experience. I feel like a spiritual being having a human experience. Thank you.
I share my colleague's connection with physical, emotional traumas with back surgery and prostate cancer surgery, both very recent and rather sad. Eastern fix right now. If I start to chant, it would be important, more because of the medications I've had to take to deal with pain and Buddhism. Two or three points. Point number one, a reminder that Christianity is an Eastern religion. The Pope said something two or three years ago that I took some umbrage at, with half of it, and I knew where he was coming from, a little bit of fear, but the second half of what he said I thought was absolutely true. He aware that Eastern religion, and Thomas Merton, one of his flock, was instrumental in moving a lot of people, including me, eastward, had taken its toll in some of the faithful. So the first half, warning the flock against Buddhism, I took some umbrage with. I was working with the Dalai Lama. I thought it was bad advice and so forth, and unnecessary. The second, where he said, we can get you there too, I think is very true. And there will be a problem for Mormons here, but it shouldn't be. And that is the absence of feeling that you have because of the restoration in 1820 or 30. No connection with the Christianity of 2,000 years before. And that's baloney. If you can be satisfied just with Deseret Book, you know, there's a whole corpus of Christianity there, the early fathers, the writings of the early fathers and mothers, from and others, and a great favorite of mine, and where I sort of entered in, Evelyn Underhill, a great Anglican mystic, who wrote Mysticism, which my son gave me in, I think, 1978, when he felt my inclinations in this direction. And for me, a decade before I met the Dalai Lama and his cabinet and had personal contact and worked personally with them, I was reading early Christian mystics, And mystic's not a good word for a person from Mormon culture, because you kind of think of up, table up, or some strange version, when it really just means spirituality, a deep spirituality. Of course, the church, and I mean any church, or synagogue, or temple, is nervous when you begin talking about Christian or Buddhist or whatever mysticism, because you are saying, in effect, that the mediation of the church, while important, maybe, is not the final word. It is not even a necessary word to the union with God. There is no mediator. You can talk about Jesus Christ, but God, that is God. And the rest is put in a perspective that is different. Maybe you can call it lesser. It is just simply less central, because it doesn't take ordination or this or that. We're all ordained, and we were in the creation to have union with God. So don't think that one must have to go to Buddhism for much of what we are saying. It's there in the Christian faith, and the Pope, I think, was entirely correct in that part of what he said. Having said that, the last week of Merton's life is so instructive. I remember my first talk with the Dalai Lama a long time ago. You want to talk about two people. You want to talk about Brigham Young, and you want to talk about Thomas Merton. You know, I read a lot more Merton than him, and a lot more Brigham Young than him. And we began talking, and he told of his affinity with, and it was obviously a moving thing. This time, and it extended several days at His Holiness' request, as Merton would go on into Bangkok and death. His only televised speech was, as he said, goodbye to the people, and then took a shower and was evidently electrocuted. And it was clear that Merton and the Dalai Lama had a much greater affinity for each other because of common practice that's been well described, which they're both done by whatever title, or always by whatever name, had brought them into an affinity that was instant and recognized and bonding with an obvious emotional pull. When I saw the emotion in his face and constriction in his voice as he talked of Merton, and his regret that they didn't have longer to be together, and telling me of his putting Merton over several days after, come back again, Merton just stayed there for a while. So point one, remember this, the names are many. I met Merton because I was running out of gas in the MX fight, and I see some old allies in the MX fight here. I was running out of gas. I've been preaching for so long, it was so discouraging. All of our congressmen, all of our senators, even the governor had written a letter inviting MX here. He was greater to be a great MX opponent. But I was running out of gas, and someone in Santa Fe said, "You're a very different Mormon. Are you lonely?" And I thought, my hell, I am lonely. I'm rich. It took me about an hour and a half catch up on that. But I thought, wow, I didn't realize how lonely I was. And I began talking with the Catholic sisters. I take the bishops, the Catholic bishops, into a magnificent statement against nuclear weaponry after the First Presidency had come out with three seminal statements against war within a six-month period, the greatest First Presidency concentration of effort on any topic that I know of, at least. And I met two phenomenal women, both of them still alive. Mary Lou Tobin, the only woman to be at Vatican II with speaking privileges, one of four in an 1800 old men convention, after a Belgian priest had prayed to God in the Pope's presence to forgive the universal church for representing 47% of humanity with men rather than the 53 that weren't. And four people, and Luke came, Mary Luke Tobin, and she's a centenarian, so she's 100 years old. I just went on retreat with her at the Marix, the Sisters of Loretto Mother House. She and her partner, Helen Saunders, their history, both essentially 100, is the history of Christianity in the United States today, in their order. What wonderful woman. And Rosemary Lynch, my dear Franciscan sweetheart, 89 years old. We go to Rome all the time, and she walks me to death on the cobblestones. They introduced me, Luke, to Merton, and Rosie to Francis Assisi and Claire. and a whole world, and basically the way people should preach, by their actions. I just watched these women. I thought, wow, I've met Frances. She's a woman, but she's Frances. And Luke, in her powerful mind, this huge mind and tender heart. And we both went through the MX wars together. Strange place to meet God when you're running out of gas. The Air Force sort of fills you up one way or the other. And that's the way I did. And it was no more east than my Roman Catholic sister, beloved friends. And from there, you know, William Shannon's Silent Lamp. It was a seven-story mountain, of course. As a great autobiography of a very young Merton, he later disclaimed some parts of its effusiveness. Richard Rohr, a great Franciscan retreat master that I go on retreat with frequently, is a new report in my life. Benedictine spirituality generally, even Jesuit spirituality, Ignatius of Loyola, anyone with a little high-low problem, bipolar or just plain effusiveness to depression. The essence of Ignatian spirituality is for every high, there is a corresponding low. So modify your highs. Don't get up in the stratosphere too high because you're going to have a low that's going to match it. He did it lying down, deeply wounded in a jail. He meditated and came up with the essence of Ignatian spirituality. And this is from the Christian tradition, Anglican, Roman Catholic, Greek Orthodox, Russian, and we're entitled. We needn't see things before the Restoration, however we envision that to be. And I look at it as aspirational. The church needs restoration. We should be about it, not historical per se. You are entitled to think of all that God did before 1820 as other than prologue. What a way to treat St. Augustine's Confessions. Prologue to what? With Jesus Christ for the Christian as being the epitome. And for men after that, it's epilogue. Okay, point two. So Christianity is Eastern. Yes, Jerusalem was destroyed in 70 by Titus. And it goes through Rome and Constantinople and whatever to find us on the American frontier in the 1900s. But it is Eastern in its origin. And if you read the New Testament with that in mind, wow, what jumps out. A practice is vital, and I want to come to that. But point two, Buddhism, and here's where I would disagree with the half of the papal statement. Buddhism is portable. And that's the wonderful thing about it. You can define it as a religion if you wish. And the Dalai Lama and I pray as a God king. I'm not sure to whom he prays, but I don't think it's himself. Maybe, that's okay. I don't ask him. But it is portable. It is either the psychology of spirituality or the spirituality of psychology. And you can pick it up like a suitcase and drop it very safely. Most of us are not going to convert, if meaning leave Mormonism to something else. The Dalai Lama and I talked about this on our first meeting. There were some people from Santa Barbara, and I mean classically from Santa Barbara there, and he was sort of, and I said, look, my sort of aggressive way, look, I'm not here to convert. I'm a Christian. He laughed and said, you be my Christian monk, and I'll be your Buddhist monk. And I said, you got a deal. And he talked to me about the problems of conversion. He meant, and I would mean it, not as a Methodist and a Mormon switching places, but as a Christian into Buddhism, into Islam, into Hinduism. And that doesn't mean it can't happen. He wasn't saying that it couldn't be legitimate. But he was warning, especially when it was his case and most surely mine, we were talking of our ethnicity and hence our tribe and hence our person. Finding yourself is not easy. I remember sitting for 3 years in an Episcopal communion where I still go occasionally before I would stand and repeat the creed because I had to make damn sure I agreed what I was saying. And I stumbled over the Arian-Athanasian conflict and I still don't quite know what's what because the New Testament says both of them so abundantly, God in the flesh and who am I praying to? Oh, God up there. And when I could say it with meaning, and I've heard John, when it comes to substance, I just said one in John 17, the prayer of the great high priest, and let Ignatius and Athanasius duke it out. I'm not going to emphasize my work with the Dalai Lama simply because it's not portable. I mean, I can't so say, go find yourself a Dalai Lama. So I'm going to talk about where I am right now. And I'm about through. Point three, the importance of silence. As a blabby law professor, my petitionary prayer was really something to behold, as anyone who's had to endure family prayer with me might remember. And to listen is an interesting thing, to be silent. Just be present. And boy, we programmed as Mormons to be active in every sense. To think of a retreat as something other as a preparation meeting for adding three more jobs in the Sunday school at MIA is a very interesting thing. A retreat with Richard Rohr or a great Buddhist master, it is a wonderful thing. And four, in my older age, I would amend what I said at the Cathedral of the Madeleine, only part of which is remembered is ordaining women. You know, dealt with, Jesus and Jung and Gandhi, and I talked of Carl Jung's criticism of a Christianity that was far too transcendental, the other God rather than the immanent God. And that was very important to me then, it still is. But after emphasizing that in reaction to my own upbringing, and after all, the McDougall lecture was just my way of fessing up. I did not tack a thesis on the temple door. I know how to do that very well had I been about that, and I wasn't. Didn't even get out a press release. I got up and told my own story, and all hell broke loose. And that is, the transcendent God is vital, too. In the time since then, as I've corrected my own balance, and I'm a Libra. Always, on the other hand, decisions are tough and you can see the other side always endlessly. So silence and non-silence. And the transcendent God that you grew up believing in, to me, is an ultimate truth. Lest I be swept into a narcissistic pool forevermore. To see God Almighty as the absolute transcendent other is vital to me and it puts me right in my place. Wow, does it ever. I do that in the desert with my son, taking photographs, or looking at a starry night, too. But a remembrance of the fear of God, the transcendent, ultimate other. And a practice that for me, as a good Mormon, or good whatever else, involving a scripture, is vital, a meditative scripture. I had a book, I had a house fire and lost a lot of volumes. One of the great losses was a book published in 1794, handed down through the maternal line of Mormondom, 12 years before Joseph Smith was born, into the hands of a woman who would be his wife and my great-great-grandmother, and then the wife of Brigham Young, through whose loins I would come. And it was handed down mother-daughter, until mother put a hex on it and gave it to me. And I promptly burned the last, maybe first edition known, as far as our insurance company can find anywhere. Daily light. It's reincarnated, to use the Dalai Lama's metaphor, in a 1998 publication. But I get that every day, and I give it to all my kids and grandkids. And to read it, to be on the same page with loved ones, their morning and evening prayer. It came down through the Mormon lineage, through an Anglican prayer book. You get your version of it. Finally, the importance of liturgy, the walk, for me, for all of us. To have a place in your home that is your sanctum sanctorum. To do a cloister walk. To have a place where the numinous of yourself and your own life with God and your fellow mortals is present with you. I use a prayer wheel that the Dalai Lama gave me, but it needn't be that. It can be anything. Your life, as you do a prayer, my friends in Dharamsala go around their temple clockwise, the way you would do a cloister walk. And I do this in my home, really. And when I'm outside, I've you can have a liturgical experience of all it is, the sagebrush, the trees, I'm a fellow tree lover, and places. I've got the First Church of St. Francis and Clare on the Mount, where I walk my little Australian shepherds, Francis and Clare, born on Easter Sunday, and right around the holiness of the land, to see everything as holy. That's important to me. Later on Saturday, there'll be more or less an autobiographical session. Anyone want to talk about the Dalai Lama or whatever, that's fine. But for me, the final point would be my belief, and here I differ with a lot of my children, maybe most of my children, in the personal God of St. Paul and Jesus, the Abba prayers of Romans 7 and 8, and the Gospel things, where really Jesus is saying, Daddy. I mean, a literal translation would be Daddy, Daddy. That intimacy with God, rather than seeing it as the divine all in all, which is also true, is important for me, and hence why I need, as the Dalai Lama's people do, and the Christians have, a God-man or God-woman, the embodiment of God in us, for us to follow. Thank you.
I'm mindful of Dan's comment that an important reason for us to be here is for everybody to be able to have a chance to share, who wants to take that opportunity. And Ed Jr. and I have about 15 minutes collectively if we stay on track. So I'll just tell my story briefly and look forward to the other sharing that goes on. The story I'd like to tell, at least the first part of it, begins about 6 years ago when I went to get some additional continuing legal education credits to a conference on mediation that was offered. And in a breakout session, there was kind of an intriguing person sitting in there, a Zen Buddhist master and abbot of a monastery by the name of Genpo Roshi, who just recently came up with a facilitated process to help people just get a touch or a taste of this non-dual awareness, which is this enlightenment state that the Zen tradition and many other traditions help people work towards in their practice. Very interesting fellow. He's probably the most prominent Western Zen leader who's moved his whole headquarters to Salt Lake City, in case you didn't know. And an hour and a half later, I walked out of there just with my mind blown. Not only did I have a taste of this experience, but I was stuck in it. I was stuck in it for about 2 weeks. And it's not only a sense of being one with all things physically, but relationally with everything, with nothing. It's just an extraordinarily different. The full spectrum of energies, that kind of thing. So I immediately began working with a group, working with energies, given sort of the spectrum of development models of developmental emergent energies and functions, and ran into kind of an interesting situation in trying to interface deep meditation and non-dual space with energies, and discovered that each energy has kind of a polarity to it, and there's one kind of voice or one kind of energy in the middle, which brings that those two polar energies to a resting point. And I just call that a still point energy. And it's really a portal into big mind. And it's fascinating work, and I worked on it weekly for years. And a couple of years ago, I was doing sort of a little demonstration of it over in Boulder at the Integral Institute. And at the end of it, this woman came rushing up, and she's dedicated her life to a South Indian dance, yoga, dance, yoga, meditative tradition. And that particular South Indian tradition, which is a couple of thousand years old, works with polar energies, with a goddess of the still point that brings those energies to rest, to sort of a pure spiritual space. And the first four energies and the first four still point voices were the exact names of the peace point goddesses of those first four chakra energies. So it was a sort of a chakra practice. You're never inventing anything. You're always kind of rediscovering ancient wisdom that's there that people have been able to access for years. And so I've worked into kind of an integral approach to the big mind process and work with it, not within a religious tradition, but in terms of a developmental practice for personal integration and transformation. It's been a wonderful experience and I think a fine complement to my life in an active Latter-day Saint, as an active Latter-day Saint practitioner.
I had prepared some remarks, which I will give to Dan, and maybe they'll be published, and maybe they won't. I, too, will try and make this very quick and give you a somewhat different path to Zen than the ones you've heard. As Dan mentioned, my training is in nothing even remotely connected with Zen. By training, I'm a linguist and a historian of the Near East, and Zen seems a very long way from that, as it does from my Mormon beginnings. And how I found myself where I am today is perhaps too long a story to go into here in any length, but suffice it to say that at the end of this journey, I found myself working as a photographer, as a fine art landscape photographer, which also seems somewhat remote from Zen. But for me, photography was actually the gateway to Zen. Early in my new career as a photographer, I had an opportunity to do a workshop on photography. And as I thought about the things that I thought most important to try and communicate to people interested in maybe just improving their photography, I was surprised to see that most of them had nothing to do with photographic technique or the craft of photography, but were much more about my relationship to what I was photographing. They were much more in the vein of sort of reflections on spirituality of photography, if you will. And at this time, I just happened upon a book by Alan Watts, who's been a gateway for many others to Zen. And it seemed to me that what he was saying about Zen was very much of a piece with what I was learning about the appeal of photography for me, which was the notion of being present in what you are doing. And one of the things that makes photography unique as an art form is that you have to be present in order to take a picture of a thing. And that presence, that being present, is or can be more than physical. And so that began a period of reading and thinking a lot about Zen, and Zen became kind of my philosophy of photography, and photography became my practice of meditation. Lately, I have come upon another modality of Zen. It's historically perhaps not entirely that, but spiritually it is. It came about as a result of the exhibits I do each year in Yellowstone. I was watching all these Japanese tourists come in and thinking, frankly, you know, how I could capture them as customers. And it occurred to me that it might be fun to do a book of haiku, Japanese haiku, and my photographs. And to make a long story short, I did such a book, and that has introduced me to the wonderful world of Japanese haiku, which I think is among the most perfect embodiments of Zen. The great English translator of haiku, Reginald Blythe, to whom we owe our first and best introduction to haiku, it's the book that all the flower children of the 60s used when they were discovering things Eastern, said that if there were any conflict between Zen and haiku, the Zen goes out the window. And I have to agree. Zen, by its very nature, I'll read you the last paragraph of what I was going to say today. Zen, by its very nature, must be incarnate. It arose as a reaction to and transformation of the airy and abstract world of classical Buddhism. It is Buddhism humanized by the practical Chinese and the earthly, earth-loving, ancestor-worshipping Japanese. Incarnated in Zen, in haiku, Zen is the acute and sensual appreciation of the commonplace, of the here and now, of human and all other forms of life as they are woven in and out of one another. It provides us with an ethic that is similarly earth-centered, here and now oriented, and locally based. It is blessedly silent, where the creeds feel compelled to pontificate. Like the highest expressions of the Judeo-Christian tradition, it honors and redeems poverty. I resonate with that, which is good news for an overindulgent people who, as Wendell Berry says, must learn to live more poorly. It recognizes that emptiness, not fullness, is the origin of creativity, understanding, and enlightenment. Zen and its flowers, especially haiku, are a tonic for our times. As Shiki said, to ears defiled by sermons, a cuckoo. Or in the words of Saisen Sui, I believe in Buddha, the green ears of the barley, the absolute truth. Thanks.
I appreciate all those, and I feel bad for you two to be so worried about the clock when we're talking about presence and timelessness and all those things. So I hope you didn't feel anything coming from any of us on that. But thank you for that, and I hope that you will, in interaction with the people, share more as you do. But thank you very much. I think this is set a really nice stage for what now really we do have. Our goal of 32-33 minutes for discussion, so it's terrific. I would love it if maybe some of you would want to come up here and share a bit of your experiences. Try not to do the 15-minute versions, but share a little bit about your own experiences with this. Sunstone, in many ways, is a chance for us just to look for other people as models or as, to give us ideas of things that we might want to try. And so if you've had something successful in this sort of way, enhance your LDS spiritual life and make you feel more complete, please come up and share. If the energy of that kind of does, we'll go off to a little more directed questions. But I think let's make this first part about your own experiences. So please pop up as you feel this. What spirit, or what would it be as your non-dual cause, as your original face urges you up?
I've gone through a couple of sessions at the Kansian Zen Center, and so I was quite interested in, John, what you had to say. And I was glad to hear that someone else had trouble getting into the lotus position. I have been meditating off and on for 20 years or so, and not very successfully. And so I'm kind of looking for some ideas for those of us that maybe haven't gone deeply enough. I've had better luck with my yoga practice, which I found has helped me in reducing stress, and I have really enjoyed various types of yoga, currently doing the Bikram yoga, the hot yoga. You know, I just wondered if you could maybe make some observations for some of us that have kind of gotten our feet wet, but maybe haven't really made the progress that we would like, either one of you. Or any of you that have meditated.
It was dangerous for me to get up here. What I found with people starting meditation, the initial period is the most difficult time because they're not quite sure what to expect. And your mind and body will resist your attempts to meditate in the beginning. Your mind doesn't want silence. Your mind doesn't like silence. And as you try to attain a center of silence, it'll just accelerate its activities, be very distracting, very tormenting. On top of that, you often have the problem of most human beings go through life by coping, and they cope by repressing a lot of disturbing things. And it takes a bit of energy to keep that down. But when you meditate, you start to ease up. Well, that stuff that's been repressed for so long starts to surface. So I've worked with a lot of folks who they'll go to meditate and they'll say, this doesn't work. I get anxious, it's upsetting, my mind goes crazy, and you know, it scares them and they just don't want to persist. So getting through that initial period, you really have to approach it with some faith that this is a good thing, it works. It's worked for thousands of years for a lot of folks. And that whatever happens to you while you're meditating is the right thing to be happening. So if your body needs to release physical stress or psychological stress or emotional repression, it's going to do that to bring you into a state of balance. And once you get through that, then you're going to settle into, you know, this more peaceful, blissful sort of thing that we talk about.
I really labored with this question a lot during the Olympics. I was running the non-denominational meditation, official meditation center. And you'd have people just rolling in, you know, for fun to see what it was all about. And to me, what seemed to work the best with the feedback I would get, you know, there's really two basic orientations towards meditation. One is a focused meditation. That's a focusing of your mind, and another is a, sort of an open awareness and just a watching. And just to be able to count your breaths up to 10 without thinking of anything else, and then realize you only made it to 3, but the next time you can make it to 5. Yeah, literally, it's just a little bit of a simple training connected to a very primal, central, physical function is a wonderful startup for learning to control the mind and relaxing around that concentration. The other thing is the exercise of not trying to suppress anything, letting anything flow out of your mind that wants to flow out. I mean, that's what it is. It's a thinking machine. But just watching it without judging it. Even if it's a hateful thought or a jealous thought or it's whatever it is, just neutrally watch it. And you realize that there is an awareness that's deeper than your thinking. And those are those two main branches of meditation, a good startup.
A few years ago, I was in kind of some deep spiritual trouble, and I found a book called Falling Apart, When Things Fall Apart, and the Children, and it really literally saved my life at that time, and I wondered if you would address the differences between Tibetan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism, and maybe talk about the practice of Tonglen, which I found so useful.
Shoot. Well, Zen Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism are both strains, you might call it, of Mahayana Buddhism. And the oldest stream of Buddhism in Southeast Asia is Hinayana Buddhism, which is more about attaining this oneness and total isolation. You reach nirvana, you're away from everybody else, and that's the ultimate. The Hinayana tradition came out of that to say, and then what is our duty? It's to go back and work with others in the world to overcome suffering. And the Zen tradition is so deeply connected to the non-dual state and being back to the ordinary life, you know, as Ed expressed it. The Tibetan Buddhism is so much more elegant and complex, that deals with many different energies, many different aspects, and it really deals with the energetics of life. I mean, it's the closest to the Mormon approach of any of the Buddhist traditions, in that you reach up high, but you come down low and work with the energies. And it's also tantric in approach, in that it recognizes the highest accomplishment of spirituality is in the shared yang and yin dynamic of the man and the woman, and the highest spiritual practice relates to the unity that comes out of that complementary practice. And it's often focused on the sexual aspect, but that's just sort of a lower, albeit very sacred aspect of that practice too. And the Tonglen practice is a practice of breathing in the suffering of the world and converting it into the wisdom and compassion which you find in that universal within, and breathing it out as a practice of a healing practice with the world. So that's in very brief. I don't know if you'd...
I might just add one interesting little anecdote from Alan Watts's in his autobiography. Alan Watts has a choice little story, one of many, about I think it was a dinner that he attended with a visiting abbot from Japan, Zen abbot, and an American fan of Zen. Who kept pestering the abbot all through dinner about how he would define Zen. And the abbot finally said, "Eat." That was his suggestion and definition of Zen at the same time. And that really embodies the tradition of Zen in the monasteries and elsewhere, which is often very counterintuitive. You know, you get these young adepts going to the monastery to become spiritual giants, and maybe they get a slap in the face or rude and uncomfortable treatment from the abbot. And the whole point of that is really to kind of wake them up. Zen is really a wake-up call. It's not about doctrines. It's not necessarily even about a practice. Alan Watts was notorious, for example, as a kind of free-loving, free-living person, and took his own very decidedly different course in Zen, very unorthodox course in Zen. But I think he embodied it in a lot of ways in this spirit of eat, live, love. Not, you know, is it orthodox? Is it energetics? Is it this or that? It's living. It's being present. And the little story of the dinner is a great illustration of that.
In my function is reminding us that Christianity is an Eastern religion, just two or three titles. Merton began a lot of this movement eastward. I mean, in his time, it began east. But some was writing, Zen and the Birds of Appetite, The Way of Chang Tzu, and The Asian Journal of Thomas Merton, his last, are three splendid books that he's done on this general topic, and also a story to match Eddie's, and a reminder that Joseph Campbell is going to be on, I think, Channel 7, I think Sunday, at any point soon, and you'll see the great, what I would mean by the cloister walk or any kind of liturgical expression by a master. But he told a similar story, and it was the Zen person in an ecumenical interfaith actually gathering. Once kept saying, "What is the theology of Zen?" And the monk thought a while, and he said, "We dance." And that's similar. And Joseph Campbell told that story. It happened evidently in his presence.
This talk about Thomas Merton makes me want to recommend his book, Contemplative Prayer, to those of you who might not know of it. I'm from the area of Kentucky, New Hope, Kentucky. I used to live 6 miles from the Abbey of Gethsemane where Thomas Merton had his stability. And my husband and I founded a small community for families, an intentional community in 1972 called the Families of St. Benedict. And it lasted for 10 years. And it was, when I was there, we were introduced along with some monks to Zen Buddhism. And they were kind of being, learning it themselves. But I didn't go very far. Merton was my biggest influence when I was there, and I still recommend him. But I didn't go very far with the Zen Buddhism, and then about 10 years ago, I kind of stumbled into Vipassana meditation with a teacher named Shinzen Young, who's a Jewish man from L.A., and I was going to say to you, Vipassana, he described that tradition as a kind of paint-by-numbers meditation. And I think, you know, the snob in me wants to do Zen Buddhism, which is like jazz riff or something. I don't know, totally free. But I've been very helped by Vipassana, which is extremely simple and also very forgiving in a certain way. It's gentle, very gentle. And it's totally, I thought I was I've been a contemplative Christian forever, but it deepened my ability to, it helped by cultivating presence and not just receiving it freely as a gift. It made us a much stronger team, God and me.
I have some questions, and I think as I've sort of had that same feeling where I'd like to find something more transformative to myself, for myself, to add to my Mormonism. And so as I've done some reading, the two things that I've come across that have kind of caught me and troubled me, and I would like to get some insight into them a bit. One, you should pick a tradition and then stick with that, because if we try to merge things together too much, then sort of like an unenlightened mind can't come up with a system that could transform it. And so so I wonder about that, and I think if I were to pick a system, how do you choose one? Do you choose one that helps you strengthen your weaknesses, or do you choose one that helps you strengthen your strengths? How do you go about that? And then the second thing that I came across that is that it's important to find a teacher. And I think, well, how do I find a teacher? So do those questions make sense? Okay.
Different styles and methods are going to appeal to different folks. She mentioned the Vipassana. I think it's okay to experiment initially. I tried three or four. Helpful. I hit this particular kind of mantra meditation that for me did it, and I felt at home there. And I think it was significant for me to stay with it. and to develop and to deepen in that practice. But regardless of the way that you take or the technique that's used, I mean, really techniques is all they are, you're really trying to, as I described the definition, my definition of mantra, you know, you're really working through the incessant activity of the mind, the conditioned emotions that have developed through your whole life, and settling into pure spirit. And when you're communing with really the pure presence and nature of God, that's what's transformative. It's that communion that's transformative.
I would really reinforce the point that if you're into a modality of contemplative awareness, it's very helpful to have somebody who's a senior person in that lineage that's perfected it. Because, you know, we go awry very easily and we're self-deluded very easily and we don't understand our own experience all the time. So I think it is good to find a teacher for, that doesn't mean it has to be all of a sudden an alternative to your faith tradition, but to get deeply into a particular type of meditation or a particular type of practicing, that's very, very helpful. And being affiliated with the Integral Institute and the Integral Spiritual Center, we're always talking about integrally informing your own tradition and deepening your own tradition. And it's kind of intriguing to me in the Mormon tradition that we have, you know, being a prophet, a revelator, and a seer, which really represent three of the four major spiritual modalities, sort of they call it nature mysticism, being connected prophetically, deity mysticism, which is having a direct experiential relationship with deity, and then there's the seer, sort of like the witness, or causal mysticism. And we don't have in the Mormon tradition a very deep understanding of that modality. Tradition doesn't touch. And so I think different... Well, that's not me. different traditions aim at those different modalities. And I think there's some richness in kind of thinking about that and maybe having a multiple practice that gives you a richer experience because you experience different kinds of places to be in a meditative way.
I'm a philosopher, not a practitioner, but so I have a kind of theoretical yet practical question for you. I teach religion and philosophy, and I've always been attracted to the Kyoto school of Japanese Buddhism, Japanese Buddhist philosophy, and to Buddhist ideas like impermanence and the idea that there's no permanent soul, anatta. I also have concerns. One thing I think is Mormons would do well to study the Pure Land Buddhist notion of the Bodhisattva, because it seems a lot more like the Mormon God than traditional theism. Because, you know, here we have a human being that becomes enlightened, creates a pure land for those of us who aren't going to be enlightened right away to get to. This is what I'm hoping for. But there seems to me, you know, there was a discussion between John Cobb and Masaya Abe at Claremont for a long time. It seems to me that and this is my question, this is the wrong way of getting to it, but I'm wondering how you integrate your Mormonism and your Buddhism. And Buddhism is very nice and it doesn't demand, you know, unique membership like the Mormonism sometimes almost seems to do. But still, there's an idea in Buddhism of the importance of non-attachment. Whereas in Mormonism, it seems that we are attached to something very important, and that's our wives and families and children. And that you shouldn't unattach from that. If you've ever seen Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, this is the problem that's presented in the film. And I was wondering how you deal with the problem of attachment and non-attachment.
That's a good one.
having been married and divorced more times than anyone else on this panel, perhaps collectively I may be ideally designed to approach that. But I remember the wife by whom I bore all my children, she bore all my children, all our children, in her last symbolic statement to me as a very, very supercharged male Mormon guy who saw the Cathedral of the Madeleine speech basically as fessing up rather than indicting an institution about patriarchy. She said, you hold like this, not like this. And that would be what I would say. I would not worry very much about, I think these questions are joined. I wouldn't worry too much about having such a heterogeneous collection of whatevers that you're not rooted. The 13th, for those of you who need permissions, the 13th Article of Faith through St. Paul gives you a bunch. And I think there's a huge truth. Ultimately, we are all our own church, and I don't invite any member, including my kids. My beliefs are uniquely mine, and they've been hard fashioned over a lifetime. And when I go to meet my maker, which is all the time, that will be who I am and what I present. And it will flow naturally to you. If you want to look for teachers, both on a bibliographic scale and personally, there are a host of things. Go to any Thomas Mertenschaffer, Alan Watts, or the Dalai Lama. Abundant, wonderful books. And local people, and Creedence Cassettes. You've got all of the Dalai, all of the Merton's, who was a retreat master at Gethsemane. You've got all of his recordings of his, all of the lectures he gave the monks, his novices. You got a wonderful book by Patrick Hart, a buddy of mine who was a novice to Merton, just out, the intimate Merton. You got shelves of Buddhist and Christian and other things. Pick them out. And the serendipity will take care of the rest. You'll meet your master. It'll happen. Maybe somebody already know, or the conduits are surely there.
Just one other thought is that, you know, if we talk about finding ourselves as we lose ourselves, as we find that true bigger realization of who we are, and maybe even the ultimate state of this non-dual being one with everything, where you care about nothing, you literally have no care because everything is you. But then as you come out of that, transpersonal wisdom and transpersonal compassion are so expansive because, well, let me just put it this way. Transpersonal compassion is as expansive as it is because it's grounded in not caring. It is able to care so much. It's able to walk through a field of carnage with absolute compassion and quietude and helping people in total self-control because it's rooted in a deep oneness, and then it gives you an ability to reach back down and embrace the world and most intimately embrace your family. And I think there's some real interesting things in that that can be correlated with the wisdom out of our own tradition.
Just a quick thought. I think most of us realize that the deepest spiritual truths are always at the crossroads of contradiction. They're always in the guise of paradox. And being unattached is not the same as being detached. And you know, the teachings of Jesus are just full of that contradictory stuff. So when you see contradictions like that, how can I be, you know, unattached but yet still connected? That's where you're going to find the real gems of truth at those crossroads. Attachments is a trap because we are attached to expectations and wanting things to be a certain way. My wife and I were in some conflict some years ago, and I was so attached to solving her problem, meeting her needs, feeling responsible for her feelings and distress, and I was so glued to that I really wasn't being helpful at all. I was really smothering her, and I had to find a way to step back and detach from her pain as much as I wanted to solve it and allow the freedom for her to move and for things to resolve. And really, by my detachment, it
resulted in a much more significant attachment between the two of us. So it's a wonderful thing.
Dan, it is no wonder, it should be no wonder, that the Sunstone Symposia have flourished so well. And as you know, I'm a devotee of some 25 years of that experience, and this panel is why. That is, I think we really connect while we're here on not every occasion. You may suffer, as I have this morning already, in other sessions, and in those sessions I try to become an anthropologist and I just observe what is going on from a quasi-scientific point of view. The questions that were on my mind to ask have already been addressed extremely well during the three responses that were given while I was sitting there. But maybe there is a lingering echo of that of those questions that could still elicit some comment. I am interested in the idea of synthesis versus relinquishing, and in the process of people's spiritual journeys. And you have alluded to that already with your idea of unattached versus detached, which I think is a wonderful concept. In a sense, we broaden our former religion when we interpret its symbols and myths more broadly. We provide more room until we finally reach the point where it no longer exists as it is practiced around us. My companion and I in the mission field many years ago would sometimes, well, I remember this comment as we retreated from a door where we had been treated fairly aggressively in the name of open-mindedness. I'm very open-minded, but... And I remember my companion say, yes, you're so open-minded that your brains are falling out. And we do indeed emaciate our past in a way, as we acquire new insights, baggage, and one person's refuge becomes another person's mode of actually approaching the spirituality that they want very, very badly. And I think we've heard of extraordinary modes, and I thank all of you for the insights that you have shared with us, the generosity of your sharing means a lot, I think, to every one of us, because we all take steps and stumble, and we all wonder that because we can never take all the steps, and our modes of walking along the path are so various. That is kind of my testimony about this panel. The variety of paths is infinite, and no one, I think, need feel apologetic that their path does not indeed fall within the footsteps of somebody else's. I'm sorry, that was a bad question.
We have time for a brief thing, and then Parker.
a great comment by a dear friend of many decades. Eddie and I had a just one little idea, since it's already been treated so well, I think, by you, Ardeen. Eddie and I were talking about this, at least I was talking to Eddie about this. I think the happenstance of who teaches us. For me, it was Merton at a particular time, always St. Paul, other than deity. St. Paul for me, Ephesians 2 and my life. But it was, I was ready for Merton, and for it was Alan Watts, and I think they are fungible in that sense. When we're ready, the right teacher shows up, and it just happens. You can call it serendipity or synchronicity, but it happens, and it's more to do with us than Thomas Merton or Alan Watts as competitors, I think.
I want to say first that many years ago I was associated with Phil when he was such a terrible guy, and so I'm so relieved that he's made this project. We worked hard with him, and my question, I think, is a rhetorical question. I've been impressed that some of you find that your meditation practice is so compatible with your Mormon experience. So I was thinking about that, and I imagined this scenario of a stake president who encouraged, in fact, directed all of his bishops to teach meditation practices of the ward members so that they'd be incorporated as part of the sacrament. And my question is, how long do you think it would be before the Correlation Committee would embrace that fully for the entire church?
I'm sorry, I was very late coming in. I was held up somewhere else, but I have wanted to ask these questions for... help me. Number one, are there female Buddhist priests? Yeah. Oh, okay, I'm really happy to hear that. And the other one was that some of our children have been on an interesting spiritual journey with us. Others didn't care very much about it, but it has led us to explore with our children meditation and one of the things that we did is we finished the course and started practicing. Our children were just a little older than teenagers or were teenagers at the time. And it was very, very helpful for those who did study and practice to gain so much more understanding of each other as we shared the experience. And I would just highly recommend doing it with family members that you want something that will last for a long time that you will have in common. The other thing is that as a very young missionary in Japan, in 49, we had no plan. We had no way to take the gospel of Jesus Christ to a country where Buddhism had been underground for 50 years. Only Shinto was allowed to be practiced before the war. And yet many people have practiced it underground. And we found that you just couldn't start with the Joseph Smith story, because when we said that Joseph Smith saw God, they would say, isn't it wonderful? We're just so grateful for the days when we see God. And it would kind of take us back short, and my natural inclination was to say, tell me about it. And they saw God in the trees and the beauties of the mountains and the unusual things that happened in nature. And it broadened us so much that while we thought, oh, well, they don't understand what we're saying, the truth is that we didn't understand what they were saying for a while, but we worked on it. And this was the beginning at a very, very early age of realizing how differently people of the world look at the same things that when you grow up in Salt Lake City, you think everybody thinks the same. And the last thing is, one other thing we did that was a with our family, those who wanted to, was take the course where you learn to get yourself into the state with the mantra where that you can then walk on fire with bare feet and not be burned. And we all did what we did that, those who wanted to. And it was many years ago, but it was also an extremely enlightening thing that as one of our son's eyes got bigger and bigger as he was still trying to keep his mind occupied with mantra and various things, he almost backed out. But when he saw his brother do it, he decided to give it a try. I would like to know what it is about the mantra and the mindset that makes it possible for people.